Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted that Bremont will be sponsoring the Money Maze podcast throughout this year. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont. When one of the world's most successful hedge fund managers is also the architect and benefactor of the world's largest children's charity, you might be tempted to think that that's enough for most mortals, creating wealth and helping children thrive and survive through an immense charitable endeavor. But when that same person trains his sights on corporations failing to properly address their climate change transition plans, some good advice to CEOs and their boards might be to look at, or they may wish they'd paid attention earlier. So I've been in this industry since 85, and until today I've never had the chance to talk to one of the world's greatest investors, donors, and determined activists for comprehensive corporate change in addressing climate issues and attendant behaviours. So it's very exciting and it's a great honour. So welcome, Sir Chris Hone, to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Simon.
Great. Well, let's just dive in. How did your upbringing prepare you for such a successful career in finance?
Mine is a somewhat unlikely story. I was the son of a car mechanic, immigrants from Jamaica, grew up in a small town, went to undergraduate in the UK, where I did accounting and business economics. And as luck would have it, I was taught by a visiting professor from Harvard Business School who taught entrepreneurship. And he said, took me under his wing and said, you really should find a way to get to Harvard Business School. And a few years later, I was admitted. And after that, I did a short stint in private equity at Apax and married to an American who said, you've got to move to New York. So I had to find a job. And the only firm that would take me was Perry Capital. And so I stayed there for 7 years, learning about investing and focused on Europe, most of which they sent me to London to start a European investment arm. And so that's the short resume. But really, I think the key points were, as it often said, an immigrant feels a bit more like an outsider. They challenge the establishment. So I think that was a part of my psychological makeup to think in an unconstrained manner. And really, at Harvard Business School taught me that people weren't, there was no reason to assume people were smarter than you. That was what I learned there.
And you actually came out with a Baker Scholarship, which is obviously a fantastic accolade. So I'm sure you were in great demand. But as you start out in this investing world, who were your initial and most influential mentors?
I think one name that comes to mind is John Armitage, who runs Edgerton Capital, who was a dear friend when I was starting to learn and we found ourselves in common positions and got to meet him when I took a stake in the energy group, which was a Hansen spin-off, and he was just starting up at Edgerton, and we helped each other over the years, and we've stayed good friends. I think Seth Klarman, I wouldn't say a mentor, but a inspiration with his value mindset. But more than that, I think just various people who I worked with, and it's an industry you learn from experience and osmosis as much as or more than necessarily a mentor.
I suppose I'm interested that you'd had that experience at Apax, then you have spent your career essentially in the listed markets. That early stage, because it's now become so fashionable for PE and that industry to sort of grow to some extent at the cost of the listings in the public markets, what was it early on that made you tilt to the public markets?
Essentially, in private markets, a couple of things. Very hard to execute a deal. You have to find the deal. You have to find it at the right price. You might go for years without doing a transaction. It's more process-oriented than investment analysis. So, and given my psychological makeup, which is impatient, I didn't have the patience for it, or wouldn't serve my aptitude, which is not really process, but analysis. And the other point to note is companies don't sell the best businesses in the world. They don't sell those to private equity generally, they keep them. And so almost by definition, you were buying inferior businesses and you couldn't choose. Yep. So the public markets had better quality businesses than you would find in the private markets. And thirdly, it's much harder to be an entrepreneur in the private market than in the public markets. So if you want to have your own fund, I think it's easier in the public markets than the private markets.
Well, thank you. I think that's very lucidly answered. And for anyone who is less familiar with TCI, it stands for the Children's Investment Fund. It was established in June 2003 by Chris Hone and today manages circa $37 billion. Let's turn to the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, or CIFF, C-I-F-F, which you endowed and is now the largest children's charity in the world. And you've committed over $600 million to climate change initiatives, which is a huge amount, and one that I suspect we're only at the foothills of this journey for you. What's driving this passion and what's driving the Say on Climate campaign?
I think it's widely understood now that climate change is the single biggest challenge of generation and future generations for the future, in particular for poor countries. And this climate change doesn't have equal effects on everybody. So in poor countries, the soils are drying out, making it very difficult and every year harder to grow food, leading to malnutrition. So the billions of smallholder farmers who are subsistence farmers are feeling the effects of pollution of the rich world. Okay. And there's an injustice to that. And so I got into climate change because I was interested in children in poverty in poor countries. And I realized this effect more than a decade ago would occur. And so that's the motivation. And secondly, as far as the Say on Climate initiative goes, we realized that 35% of global emissions come from companies. Most companies don't have any plan to address their emissions. They don't even disclose their emissions, and there's no accountability mechanism for their owners, the shareholders, to instruct them or give feedback on what they should be doing, what they are doing. And so together with CIFF, the foundation I endowed, we came up with this concept of, it's been labeled the Say on Climate, which is very simple. It's an AGM resolution that mandates a company disclose their emissions, consistent with TCFD, specific standard. Two, they give their plan to manage those emissions, not prescriptively, however, whatever format they want. And thirdly, there's an advisory annual AGM on the plan and their performance against plan. So very simple concept, but it can make a huge difference because it will create forced disclosure of emissions and the plan to manage them. And shareholders then require through the vote management to justify their actions. And so it's an accountability mechanism. So I'm fully convinced it's going to make a significant difference on how companies look at this and the pressure on them to reduce their emissions. And we already have many large companies that have adopted it.
So when you engage with these corporates, there are a lot of behaviors that you would like to see them address, but how do you both prioritize your message and I suppose also help them understand the urgency?
Well, firstly, quite a few companies will adopt it voluntarily, but in a major part until there's regulation for the say on climate, as there is for the say on for executive pay, say on pay, in which is law in the US and the UK. You would have thought that climate change is more important than executive pay. So one has a law, the other one doesn't yet, but it will. Investors, it's clear, are willing to vote and support these initiatives if they're filed. Okay. BlackRock, very clear, they'll vote for them. They have been voting for them, for example. But they're going to leave it to the NGOs and charities, activists to file them. That's okay. That's happening now. TCI has filed a lot. CIFRS and its partners are filing hundreds, because you only need $25,000 US dollars to file on an S&P 500 company. So at $12 million, you can file on all the S&P 500 companies. You lose that money. It's just the shares you have to hold for a year. In Canada, it's $2,000. So it's very cheap to put an AGM filing. And because of the simplicity of the resolution, it's clear from cases like AENA, which got 98% support, shareholders will vote for it. And in many cases, you'll see in companies, rather than have a contested fight, they're willing to adopt it, quote unquote, voluntarily, I think, it's known as a bear hug.
Right, so, right.
Yeah, so it's happening. The trend is happening. And we've had major investors like Soros Fund Management has announced they're supporting the local authority pension plans of the UK that advise, you know, more than £300 billion. Just to name two, there's a website, sayonclimate.org, where you can see the companies that have adopted it, Canadian National, Canadian Pacific, Moody's, the rating agency, has adopted it, Unilever adopted it, Royal Dutch Shell just adopted it, Glencore adopted it, Rio Tinto Zinc. So the list is building, and these are serious companies, so nobody can say this is a joke. And it'll be down to the shareholders to make sure that the plans aren't just rubber stamped, but they're actively scrutinized, and where they're not good enough, voted against. And the proof of the pudding will be in the actual emissions and emissions intensity. If that isn't declining, consistent with the Paris Agreement, at a meaningful rate, then I would expect shareholders to vote against the plans and vote against the boards.
It was your former colleague from Apex, Ronald Kern, who said just the other day that doing harm has become risky business. And I'm intrigued, where are you meeting recalcitrance or at least some pushback?
Yeah, there's some US companies that want to fight on it. So Charter Communications, where we have 5% holding some $7 billion of stock, we've been a long-term shareholder, they've refused to adopt it, they've notified us, and so it'll go contested at the AGM, which is a little bit surprising because they're not a heavy emitter. But there's clearly the mindset will still need to change, where people think it's optional to pollute and not actually disclose your pollution, to realizing that it's not an option in the eyes of your shareholders. So these battles are inevitable. And it's important that shareholders send a message to the managements that refuse to disclose emissions or have a credible plan to manage them and refuse accountability, that won't be accepted. And so this is why I'm doing this podcast, to explain that actually greenhouse gas emissions, pollution generally, it can have an effect on long-term returns. It will, because carbon is going to be regulated. There are carbon taxes already of a significant nature in Europe, spread through the rest of the world. You lower your cost of capital if you're the greener you are. Debt and equity, and your relationships and image to your customers and employees is improved substantially the greener you are. So it's a win to do so, and it's not really optional anymore. But some companies still backward looking, and the investors need to explain that to them. I mean, the first one that I won with at AENA was contested by the board. They said vote against it, but I got 98% support. They changed their view in a final few days, but that was a fact. So it's going to be a fight in many cases. And I'm asking for shareholders to realize it's in their self-interest to instruct boards that they are the owners and they want this information. They want this accountability mechanism, and it's ultimately in the interest of the company.
I think it was the Wall Street Journal that quoted you with the example of Moody's, which said it was a mix of cajoling and public shaming. And so there's clearly a carrot and stick at work here. I guess that the thing that I'm not sure I understand is that you're a global investor, but could we be seeing a sort of a bipolar world where you get Western adoption, but you get Eastern resistance or indifference to this mission?
Yeah, so it's a good question. We want to bring it to Asia. There's already been filings made by Australian fund managers and NGOs just recently on Woodside Petroleum and Santos, two of the big oil and gas companies there. So the Australians get it. The country is sort of burning down from climate change. And so they really understand climate change is a clear and present danger. So Australia is moving now. Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull supporting that. We're going to work in Japan. We're looking to work in Korea. China, we haven't, I think, may not be possible. We have to study it. It has to be reviewed. But certainly Japan, Korea, Australia, we're going to be working in. In particular, we want to address the banks, because the banks are financing the dirty economy. And a special resolution needs to be put to their shoulders, which is disclosure of carbon intensity of loan books. They're lending on fossil fuels, oil, gas, coal. Yep. So that investors can track, are they cleaning up their loan books? Yep. And of course, it will require them to get the information from the borrowers. Yep. So we'll have a change of business practice. But how else are regulators, the central banks, going to regulate these climate change stress tests if the banks don't have the information? So the banks are a key part of the Say on Climate initiative, because they move, they finance the whole economy.
So this is a plate shift going on, but is there another structural impediment, which is the explosion of passive investing over the last three decades?
Yes. Yeah, passive investing is half of all investing and growing every year relentlessly. This is a problem because a lot of times they have no interest in engaging, voting, or they vote with proxy advisors who hold enormous power, people like ISS Glass Lewis. Fortunately, those people are supporters of the Say on Climate initiative. We saw that in AENA. They were very strongly in favor of it. But there will be a need for these companies to advise the passive investment funds to do the work properly, to assess whether plans should be approved or disapproved in performance. Fortunately, there is an acid test, which is emissions, as I said. So there's an objective test. Unlike pay, where higher pay may be justified or not justified, it's harder to assess, but in this case, higher emissions intensity can never be justified if you're trying to decarbonize.
So that's clear. And the Say on Climate mission, as we've said, we'll be releasing it with the emails that go out with this show's www.sayonclimate.org. I'd like to talk a little bit about the charity, which has clearly been an extraordinary success and vehicle, and the beneficiaries obviously have been globally dispersed. I suppose a general question is, what part of the charity has given you the most satisfaction?
No, I think I work in malnutrition, neglected tropical diseases, family planning. These are all very important things and simple. Yeah. So the health side, I think, is closer to seeing the direct impact on people. Simple things could be clean water, drilling in Ethiopia for clean water, without which people can't exist. The surgeries for people with trachoma, direct impact. Yeah, really, I think you can really see with your own eyes what's being achieved. So health side, I think, is all the programs are listed on the CIF website. But at the same time, I recognize that climate trumps everything. Ultimately, if we destroy the soil and are able to grow food, that will trump any health initiative we could ever attempt.
And do you feel sometimes like Sisyphus, you are embarked on this mission and you are a small minority? Are you surprised that there aren't others who are embarked with you vocally?
Yeah, it's an important question, because no individual can change everything, but we can set an example and do our part. And all of these things, I think ultimately these problems have a rooting and a solution in a spiritual space. Because if people want to live a life which is selfish, you know, pollute as a company or hoard their money rather than share their wealth, then we can't ever solve the problems. And so I would say the root cause is selfishness. And I'm I'm optimistic that the world is going to change, that crises like the coronavirus will show people that no one lives as an island. Everyone is impacted by the well-being of everybody else. Climate's another example of that. So these pandemics and climate change, they're a common thing that they show us. We're one world. We're not unconnected from everybody else. And so someone said to me, if you want to change the world, change yourself.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you a slightly tangential question, which is clearly market euphoria around Bitcoin, mining of Bitcoin. There was an article that talked about this equivalent electricity consumption of Chile, and the Judge Business School has just come out with some very good work on this. How would you react to, and there are some companies, admittedly they're small, suddenly deploying reserves in dollars or euros, suddenly in Bitcoin? And are you surprised there hasn't been more conversation about the obvious downside of Bitcoin's MO?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised because most investors are just passive. Bad things will happen and they don't say anything, don't do anything. I've seen it all my career. They don't act as owners. The problem is with the passive phenomenon has made it 100 times worse because suddenly half, it wasn't that many shareholders cared before, but now half of them definitely don't care.
Yeah.
Yep. They're not allowed to care. So it's a problem. I think companies investing in Bitcoin is crazy, but the fact that people don't seem to care is indicative that they don't act as owners.
So that brings us into some questions around investment strategy. I mean, your track record has been absolutely extraordinary at TCI, and we know what a difficult business this is. How, if you have altered your investment process over the years that you've run TCI, and if so, how?
Sure. We've become more quality focused in our choice of companies to invest in. When I started investing, we'd look at anything, bank, a miner, all sorts of things, and a steel company. And over the years, I realized there's good companies and bad companies, and I became more discerning at what was good and what was bad. And so realized good is better. So with quality, we became much more quality, focused on quality compounding, and less of an activist, because good companies generally tend to be well run as well. So it's, we do less activism and more let the quality of the companies do the work.
Well, of course, that actually makes me remember that we interviewed on this podcast Xavier Rolet, who, of course, ran the London Stock Exchange. You were a big holder. I have to say that for some of us, we felt very foolish when we look back and realize what we'd missed. You didn't miss the London Stock Exchange. I'm intrigued. What did you spot that others missed in that early transformation of the LSE?
I mean, I'd been invested in exchanges for a long time, right from the start of TCI and Deutsche Börse, Euronext. So we knew they were good businesses. But interestingly, Xavier had transformed the company from an exchange into a diversified financial services business, and their clearing business was an extraordinary business in SwapClear and the swap clearing. They had several others like this. So really network effects, the index business, very attractive. CapEx liked growth. So with very high barriers to entry, so driven by the passive move. So Xavier transformed the company through acquisitions, and that's continued to be the case. So really that the ability to add value through acquisitions is really something people hadn't appreciated.
Well, that demonstrated, I guess, your long-term holding perspective to which you've already alluded. I know the leading UK PR firm said that CEOs typically tremble when TCI appears on the register. Has that surprised you? And to what extent are you simply able to remove emotion, which is so often the enemy in this investing business, from the identification of opportunities?
Well, as you get older, you get more patient. As you have more capital, you get more patience. And so you, and also, one evolves, and as a human being, you realize you can probably achieve more through being constructive than fighting people. So I'm trying to work through persuasion as much as I can, because no one doubts that we're willing to file a resolution or have a fight if that's what's needed. But they also realize that we actually have the company's best interests at heart. We had a big fight with Safran a few years ago where they were overpaying for an acquisition. We were fighting it like hell, and in the end, they cut the price 40% and gave us a vote, gave it, didn't pay it in cash, not shares, and And actually, the chairman recently said they helped us. Yeah, they saved the patent leak, saved the company money, and it's indisputable. And at the time, we were not happy. Yeah, nobody wanted to be told what to do, but it was actually to the company's benefit. So it's the power of the argument. When we filed the resolution, it wasn't that they weren't happy. They found it very aggressive. But the board said, his points are reasonable. Fix the plan, make it better. And they did. So I've come to believe in the power of the argument. Saying climate is winning, not because of me or any power I could wield over a company, but because the idea resonates with people because of its simplicity and intrinsic logic.
Staying with the Say on Climate, how will you benchmark and judge yourself over the next 5 years, given how immense, at one level, the undertaking is?
Well, we could judge ourselves by the number of companies adopting it, large companies, okay, and particularly those that matter, banks, high emitters. It's all very well if Unilever, it's an important company, but maybe it's not as important as ExxonMobil or BP, yeah, in terms of emissions. So we can judge ourselves by the emissions, absolute level of emissions and emissions intensity reductions of the companies where it's filed. We can judge ourselves from the number of investors, the quantity of money run by investors who are supporting it, regulation. We want to see this as a regulation. We'd like to see it in the UK, the US, every country in the world. So number of countries, major countries that regulate it. So these are some of the metrics that we would measure our success against.
So I'd like to ask some more general closing questions. You, in your position as an immense philanthropist, I think I've read, have worked with and been in discussion with other great philanthropists like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. And I wonder what struck you most from working and speaking with some of these other figures.
Yeah, I know Bill Gates. I have a lot of respect for him. We worked together on climate and health. He authentically cares. And I think the authenticity and is important. And I just, attention to detail, Bill's, he works. He's a hardworking person. Yep. So work ethic, really highest respect for Bill Gates. And the leverage that he's created through with Warren Buffett of the Giving Pledge, where he's created a club, if you like, of people willing to give away the majority of their wealth and commit that to philanthropy. And Warren Buffett, respect for him, gifting to Bill Gates his wealth to take on. That was the greatest achievement of Warren Buffett. He's respected as an investor, but he should be more respected as a philanthropist.
Yes. Well, we haven't had Bill Gates on the show. We would love to have Bill Gates on the show. So maybe we'll have a conversation with him and be able to continue some of these themes. What advice would you give to a 20-year-old Chris Hone?
No, follow your passion. That's what I say to my son, you know, whatever it is. Life is really too short to not enjoy every day of your life and find out who you are. Discover who you are. Self-analysis, important. People think life is about doing things, okay, what you achieve. But that's all wrong. The real secret of life is who you become. So my biggest piece of advice, figure out who you want to become, not what you want to do. You know, nobody really focuses on what they did at the end of their life. It's just who they were.
So I got to ask you a very different question. I have 3 children. I think you have triplets. Somebody said to me when I went from 2 to 3, the football analogy is you go from man-to-man marking to zone coverage. What's been more difficult, managing your children or managing your investments?
Well, children can't really be managed, so. they're college now, so they university, so. Listen, I don't think they were ever manageable. Independent beings. I don't think investing is that hard. The hard part of investing is, Warren Buffett said, it's temperament. You need to have the right temperament.
Yes. A final question, which we do ask after the book of this name, which is, if you could tell our listeners just one thing.
What would it be?
Yes.
I would encourage them to evaluate who they are, who they would like to be on a spiritual level, because that drives everything. So something only recently understood the last few years, and it was an important discovery for me.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. This has been terrific for me. It's been just very informative. I think that your initiative, Say on Climate, is an unstoppable force. I think you quoted, knowingly or not, John Donne, no man is an island. And I think that is the sort of the recognition that, you know, as investors, we can't be selfish, that there are multiple considerations and consequences of all our actions. And advice to young, which is so important, is follow your passion, but also to think about who you want to become. So with that, I want to thank you once more for your time. Chris Hone, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here today.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.